This is Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Jessica Curry, who won the BAFTA Award this spring for her score for Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. Hey, Jessica, it is so much fun to catch up with you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's gorgeous to talk to you again. You're a very lovely and patient lady because I was late for this interview, so you're very nice.
Yeah, we're flexible. We're on summertime. So. And absolutely, for sure, I would love to talk with you about what that award means. But how about we start with the upcoming project, that concert performance of Dear Esther. Wow, it's really exciting.
I know. It was one of those things where I pitched it to them and I thought, this is, you know, probably not going to happen. And they were immediately very lovely and enthusiastic about it and said yes. And I was like, oh, they said yes, I actually have to do it now. So I'm in the middle of, you'd laugh if you saw my studio. I've got Dear Esther scores everywhere because it's quite a logistical challenge, actually. I've been having initial chats with lovely Austin Wintory, because as you know, he's done Journey Live. Mm-hmm. So he has lots of information and kind of knows how it works. So yeah, it kind of looks a bit like Close Encounters of the Third Kind, building the Dear Esther concert out of mashed potato here in the office today.
I would love to see that. You know, it's funny because I was lucky enough to see Austin's Journey Live concert with the Fifth House Ensemble. And on the way home, my husband and I were talking about how it only would probably work with Dear Esther. That was the only game we could think of.
Thank you.
Because both of them are such incredible experiences, and they're not like any other game. So I imagine it is taking a whole lot of rethinking about the music and just, as you say, the logistical problems of it. So
totally, just things from, you know, practical things like how to mic people, so the soundscapes and the original sound design and the actor and the musicians are blending really well, through to should there be lighting during it, is that going to be, you know, too intrusive. There's a thousand small questions that go into making a good event into something really, really magical and special. And the Barbican, where the concert's going to be at, obviously hugely prestigious venue, mm-hmm. in London, massively experienced, and they've just been really, really kind and gentle with me, kind of talking me through how it works, really, because I haven't put any of my music on live ever before, never mind something with a visual element. I've always had people doing that for me, so I'm kind of, yeah, project managing this, which is really frightening.
Well, it sounds like you've lined up a really good team to help you, and what's so cool about this is that the original narrator, Nigel Carrington, is going to be reading the letters, and then your husband, Dan Pinchbeck, who created the game, will be playing it. Are you?
He's not very happy about that, I have to say. Oh, I kind of sprung that on him, because he's really, really shy. Oh. And I said, Dan, how would you, in theory, feel about playing through Dear Esther live at the Barbican? He was like, this is not a theoretical question, is it, Jess? I was like, no, not really. So he's just about coming to terms with that fact. But I think what's really nice as well, we've got the original string quartet who played on the soundtrack.
Wow.
Playing at the concert. And it just feels like a real Chinese room family of people, actually, that are in the concert. So I think it's just going to have that very special atmosphere through dint of getting the gang back together.
Thank you.
It's like the A-team in many respects. I am the face, obviously.
Of course.
Who gets to be Mr. Might be George Hamilton, actually. Right. So.
Who gets to be Mr. T?
Yeah, that's
Dan. Of course.
So similar.
Well, it's not like this is a game you can fail at, because it's more of an atmospheric kind of game. And I didn't realize at the time what a chance you guys were taking on creating a game like this, because there hadn't been anything like this before. So it must have been just a real surprise for you guys to experience how much this game means to people and how it just really took off.
It was such a shock, because we weren't even going to release it commercially when we first made it. It was an experiment, and that initial huge sales that, you know, we were watching it go up on Steam that night, and we were just screaming and jumping on the bed because we thought my mum would buy it and some supportive friends, and it was just climbing and climbing. And what's interesting is Alex, who's one of our amazing artists here at the Chinese Room, said she went to one of the big conferences, I think it was either REST or something like that, and she said she went to, I think, 10 talks that day, and she had half of them reference Dear Esther, and she said, that's it, that's the dream, you know, you've made it when you go, it's not just about sales, but you're actually embedded into the games industry in a way that people reference it when they talk about storytelling or creating a new subgenre, and that still feels bizarre and amazing.
There are other games like it now. There's Journey and other games with a real depth of emotion like This War of Mine. So it's not that these kinds of games aren't getting made now, but it really seems like the sort of general public perception of games hasn't really matured the way games have matured.
Absolutely. I was on Radio 4 here in the UK a few weeks ago with a famously terrifying interview, and he normally interviews politicians. And, you know, he was really having a go at me, saying, but the games industry are so responsible in terms of violence and Grand Theft Auto. And then I talked about Gone Home and Journey and Dear Esther and Proteus and Rapture and these really beautiful games. And he said, well, I haven't heard of any of those. And I think the general public perception still is of these bombastic, violent, misogynistic games, which of course do form, and for me, an uncomfortable part of the industry, but there is such a rich panoply of other things going on there, and it's frustrating sometimes. And also with, you know, music and acceptance from the classical world, it feels like it's slow to come round to the fact that this industry has a lot more to offer. It's just, yeah, it is frustrating sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I started this series, because the music in games is just so incredible. And actually, it was the music in Dear Esther that like really, really got me going with this. But it's true. It's people are missing out on an incredible range of experiences, I think, by not really dipping into the world of games. And, you know, maybe still there's this perception that, well, it's just something their kids do and the games aren't mature yet. So, yeah, clearly the industry has a lot of work to do still with PR and that kind of thing. So
yeah, and it, you know, it is for me still a very difficult and problematic industry. You know, there are a lot of the content I find really horrific, and I think they don't do themselves any favors sometimes, and they push that agenda, and they're very, very slow to change. But I do think it's generational, and when I look at Oscar, my son, who's about to turn 13, his generation, they're so clued up, and there isn't this divide between gamers and non-gamers. It's just something that they all do, and the girls play different kinds of games as well. So I do think that's the generation where it will totally shift, where the idea of being a non-gamer will almost be a sort of nonsensical irrelevance.
I think so too. And the real value of the diverse music in games now too is that it exposes kids to all kinds of things, you know, music that's almost inspired by Middle Age polyphony, medieval polyphony, and then really modern stuff, and there aren't any barriers anymore. So people can just listen to this music and get excited about it and not have it pigeonholed in all these different little boxes.
Absolutely. I think that's happening in all walks of life, actually. I think those barriers in terms of culture and gender, all kinds of things, and politics. We've been a very sort of striated generation where we'd like to put things in little boxes. And it's interesting when I hear Oscar's friends talk, actually, is that they're much more open in terms of the way they talk about relationships and media that they're consuming. So I think it will change, actually.
I hope so. It seems like it is, but again, it's happening at a really snail's pace, which is just too bad. You know, earlier this summer, your music was performed as part of a concert commemorating the Battle of the Somme, and that must have been an amazing experience. Also, I wonder if now you are so visible as a game composer, if that was part of the reason you were invited, or was this a project that had gotten started before that?
No, absolutely. They had heard Everybody's Gone to the Rapture and were really interested in me writing some concert music. But what I find really fascinating and slightly terrifying is that I haven't been offered any game work since Everybody's Gone to the Rapture. And I thought that the BAFTA win would definitely open some doors. And Dan and I were talking about it last night, saying, is it because I wrote the blog post criticizing the industry? Is it because I'm a woman? Is it because I don't have an agent, which is the method that most people use to find those composers? But yeah, that door seems to have firmly closed on me.
Aww.
So I know it is really strange, but I think what I definitely will still continue to do is I'll always write music for the Chinese Room. And there was a conference in Brighton a couple of weeks ago called Develop, and I was talking to some British game composers, and they were all complaining, saying, oh, we're just asked to do the same thing every time, and we have temp tracks, and they want us to sound like the last, you know, successful thing. And I kind of thought, well, maybe I'm not missing out after all, because that is my literal idea of hell as a composer. And the Chinese Room affords me so much time and freedom and creative space. So I think what I'm going to do as I continue my career is take these amazing classical commissions that now seem to be flowing in, interestingly, from the game music, but not being offered any game work. But I'll continue writing music for the Chinese Room, and I'll get my fix, you know, in terms of media world that way, and then do my lovely classical commission. So yeah, it's been a really surprising year, actually, in terms of my career.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And I was going to ask, what it was such a huge deal to get your BAFTA award for Rapture, and I was going to ask kind of what it means to you. It was really fun to watch your acceptance speeches.
I think I might be locked in a vault somewhere, never to be seen again. And I keep meeting people at industry events. They're like, I loved your BAFTA speech. I was like, no, don't tell me you've seen it, because my mum's really cross that I swore.
Oh, it was just the heat of the moment, right?
I mean, definitely. I mean, I think going back to being a woman in the industry, no woman had ever even been nominated in that category. I genuinely wasn't expecting to win. It was a really strong year as well. There was Austin's Assassin's Creed. There was
Fallout 4.
Yeah, and oh god, I can't remember his name, and I absolutely love it. That won all the visual awards.
Gareth Coker, the Ori and the Blind Forest.
Thank you so much for jogging my old lady brain. Yeah. So you know, there's this really stiff competition. So it was extraordinary to win, actually, and it did feel political. It had been, as you know, a very politicised year for us in terms of what we want from the games industry in terms of working conditions and being treated well, treating other people with kindness, not going into crunch, all those things. So it was about the music, but it kind of felt really validating from those people who said, the time and the energy that you were allowed to put into this game by your company meant that I was able to create something really special. And I think lots of composers could do that if they were given more time, but it's still this very frustrating traditional model of coming in right at the end when all the money's been spent and there's no time left, and just doing the best you can with those very limited time resources. And Rapture grew very slowly as a score, and I was absolutely embedded and ingrained with the development team, and that was such a privilege. So I think it was a real band of brothers and sisters game. I'm not sure we'll ever do a game like that again, where it just feels so, I don't know, I can't even explain. It was such an emotional development on so many levels. So to hold that statue felt really wonderful.
I can't even imagine what that would be like, because it really is, yeah, the kind of capstone for an amazing year. And so it must, I'm sure it's got a pride of, you know, pride of place in the trophy case at the Chinese Room.
It certainly has. I mean, I was allowed to have it at home, I think, for one day. Had it on the mantelpiece, and then we're like, no, we should take it to work, because, you know, it's for everybody. So I lovingly give it a little smile every time I walk past it in the awards cabinet when I come to work every morning.
And it kind of smiles back at you too, because
it certainly does, with a little wink. Yeah. But I think it's the one that most composers want to win within the industry. It is seen as the award, and it just felt really special. And I kind of thought, if this never happens again, I'm kind of fine with it. I've done it, I achieved it. And that was really nice as well, actually, thinking I can sort of just not sit back, but I've done it. It was just a real proper deep sense of achievement.
I can imagine. And again, you know, you touched on how the creative process at your studio, at the Chinese Room, works with this long gestation period, really. And you're right in there in the beginning. Are you guys working on a game right now?
We're really busy. It's kind of gone a bit crazy here. So at the moment, we are porting Dear Esther onto console, which is really exciting because there's been a huge demand for that over the years. We've just never had time to do it. So that's happening, which is really exciting. We're working on an as yet unannounced title with a very big organisation that I will get lynched if I talk to you about in detail, but that's really exciting. We're working on our own self-funded game called Total Dark, and that's going really, really well. And we also have another iron in the fire, setting up a project that's hopefully going to be starting in about a year's time. So it's frenetic here at the moment, but in a really nice way. We have, I know everyone says it, but we have the best, most creative, loveliest team of people here, and we just couldn't do any of it without them. And it's a joy to see them every day, because it is really intense and there is a lot going on, but they just have a really amazing attitude. So it's fun to come to work every day, and that means a lot to me.
I've heard from so many people how much they appreciate being part of a small team, because then everyone's responsible and everyone supports each other, rather than just being a little worker bee in your cube in some enormous studio somewhere. So it sounds like you guys have an amazing...
Yeah, it's so true, actually. We have a lot of people who've come from large studios and don't want to work that way anymore. And one of the first things they always say, we've got a new lead artist, Steve, who's just wonderful. And he said, the first week, Dan said, this is the game I want to make. Do you all want to make it? Wow. And at the end of the meeting, you know, everyone had their say. And at the end, Steve said, I've been working in the industry for 20 years and no one's ever asked me that question of, do I want to actually make the game that we're making? And he said that he really appreciated the fact that Dan didn't want to make a game that wasn't of interest to anyone else but him. And you can do that when you have a small team, and that just isn't possible when you have 150 or 900 people. It can't be a committee decision, those kind of things. And we're agile, we're fast, and one of the big frustrations with Sony, it wasn't malevolence on their part, just big people are slow, mm-hmm. because there's so many departments that it has to go through before you can get any decision, from the smallest thing to the largest decision. It just doesn't kind of matter what the scale of decision is, it still takes an age, and it drove me mad.
Well, I can imagine. Plus, there's the whole idea that Sony is operating out of some studio thousands of miles away too, yes. probably. So
that absolutely doesn't... with that 8-hour time delay, that meant, you know, everything was slowed down even further. And like I say, they can't go any faster because they're absolutely massive. Mm-hmm. And one of the joys of small team working is just being able to be really quick and agile with decisions. If something isn't working, it's gone. It doesn't have to go through three layers of management before you can ditch it. You can just say, that's not relevant, we're moving on. So it suits our, I mean, Dan and I are quite frenetic people. So I think it suits our personalities far more.
Well, it must be nice too to have the kind of a security, I guess, of knowing that you've got several projects going on. So when you finish one, then there's another one in the pipeline, rather than just poking your head up and saying, okay, now what?
Yeah. And that's one of Dan's main jobs, actually, is always secure. You know, he's always working at least 2 years ahead for the studio. And that's what I think people go, well, how are you so busy? And you think, well, I'm not just doing what is in front of me. I'm also making sure that we have a sustainable studio. And that's really, really important to me and Dan, that we can carry on employing people. You know, the normal studio practices boom and bust, where they hire massively and then they dump everyone and start again when they work on the next title. Everyone has permanent contracts at the Chinese Room, and the assumption is that unless something goes horribly wrong, you will be able to continue working here. It's not just on a project by project basis, because people have kids and lives and mortgages and families to support. You know, that's really important to us.
It sounds like a wonderful model for a studio.
It's like a cult.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Well, it sounds like, you know, the early days of Apple when...
Oh, God, don't... Oh, God, madness lies around the corner. I've seen the film, Kate. Yeah, it is a bit hippy-dippy. We did joke that the next time some journalists come in, we're going to all wear robes and mm-hmm. chat, because I think, you know... American people accept our happiness much more easily than the English, who think there must be some horrible dark underbelly that actually lurks within the heart of the Chinese Room. As you know, the Brits are a very cynical beast. And we were interviewed recently for a national newspaper, and she kept saying, oh, come on, it can't really be. Oh, come on, tell me really what it's like. I was like, no, everyone's really nice. We get on really well. Sorry, not to give you more interesting dirt, but it, you know, Dan always says making games is hard, so it should be fun. Mm-hmm. And that's our kind of mantra, is if it's not fun, we're not going to do it anymore.
Well, what I really pick up on with your games is the pride of craft of them. It doesn't yeah. seem like anything is just thrown in there at the last minute just because it has to be there. Everything kind of builds on everything else. Everything's there for a reason, and everything just works so carefully together.
Thank you. That's a lovely thing to say. And I hope that's what characterizes us as a studio, that every blade of grass, every flower, every ornament, every audio cue has been discussed, fought over, redone, made better. Everything has to justify its place, especially, I think, because we do work within a framework that not much actually happens in our games. Everything has to be so right.
Yeah, definitely. And it shows. And I can tell that is what creates such interesting games that, like you say, just are completely unique. And so it's going to be really exciting to see, you know, what your next releases are. And of course, the concert at the Barbican in London. And Jess, it has just been so much fun to talk with you.
Oh, I always absolutely love talking to you. You've got the nicest voice. I just always feel very nurtured Aww. By you. After being mauled by the politician's nightmare oh on Radio God. 4, you are a welcome antidote. Well, a very loving, kind and gentle interviewer who always gets the best out of people. So it's really appreciated.
Oh, thank you so much. It's so much fun for me to have an opportunity to talk with you and all of your colleagues, because I'm just such a big fan. So it's mutual.
Oh, thank you so much.